Welcome to our third part in the discussion of Know Your Commentators, Tzur HaMor versus Abarbanel, where commentator and commentary meet. I'd like to compare and contrast the lives and commentaries of the Tzur HaMor and the Abarbanel. They're very different, but they have a lot of interesting similarities. And I'd like to particularly focus on their similarity in that the commentary and the commentator have a connection. Usually when you write a commentary, it's a dispassionate discussion of the text, and your own personal biography and things that you've experienced and saw are not really relevant. In the case of Rabbi Avraham Siban and the Tzur HaMor and the Abarbanel, the two meet. Who was Rabbi Avraham Siban? Many of you are familiar with the Abarbanel. Who was Rabbi Avraham Siban? Most people pronounce his name as Avraham Saba. However, it ends with an ayin, so it might be Sabag or Sabag, which is a common Sephardic name today. I don't know if that's true or not. In any event, I was not familiar with him either until I bumped into his commentary around the year 2000. And I discovered that around 1990, two different people came out with his commentary. It had been published in an obscure printing in the 1800s and was reprinted in 1990, not only by one person, by two different people. And also Rabbi Ellie Monk also came out with an English sort of abridged version as well. So, and you can even find in the back of your art school, Chumash, it's one of the people that they reference is the Tzur HaMor. If you look at collections of Vortlach, of different Divrei Torah, you'll find his name, the Tzur HaMor. If he's somewhat obscure, it has a little bit to do with his bad luck. It has a lot to do with his manuscript being lost. Let's take a look at the history of Rabbi Avraham Siban, some of his commentaries, and then we'll look at the Abarbanel, and we'll make that contrast. So who was he? He was a preacher in Castile, which is in central northern Spain, where he was born in the middle of the 15th century, right? Or before the 1492. At the time of the expulsion of Jews from Spain in 1492, he took refuge in Portugal. Okay, they expelled him. He'll go to the neighboring country. Many people thought it'd be a great place to go to, where he met with further misfortune. Scarcely has he settled in Oporto when King Emmanuel ordered all Jews to be expelled from Portugal, all Jewish children to become Christians, and all Hebrew books to be burned. So now he gets to Portugal, and now they say that you have to, there was an expulsion in 1496. His two sons were forcibly taken from him, converted to Christianity. He fled from Oporto, abandoning his entire library. And at the risk of his life, he saved his own works, which were in manuscript. So he goes to Lisbon, another city in Portugal. But before reaching there, he was told of a new order by the king decreeing the death of any Jew with whom a Hebrew book or tefillin, the phylacteries, were found. So he hid his manuscripts and tefillin under an olive tree. He writes as follows. And here's an example of that his memoirs and his writings about his own life are included in his commentary or introductions to his commentary. He writes as follows. I came to Lisbon and came to take all books and tefillin to the Beit Knesset, to the synagogue in Lisbon, at the threat of death. And they had already taken one Jew for his beloved book, and they beat him with bitter beatings and lashes. And when I heard this, I stood with great trembling, and I went with great fear and confusion, and I dug under a big olive tree that had a big root in the ground, and I buried it. The three books I wrote on the five Megillot, one book on the five Megillas, you know, Megillas Esther, Ruth, Song of Song, and Avot. I had a whole commentary on Pirkei Avot, and the Tzur HaKesef on Halachot. We're going to see that his writings on Tanakh were preserved. His writings on Halacha and Jewish law were lost. So we see he's both a Halachicist and a Talmudist, and also a interpreter of the Torah and a darshan, a preacher. On this I mourn and wail and I cry day and night, for the fire of God ate it. So here's a man who had written three major works on Halacha, on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Megillas, five different books, on Pirkei Avos. And now that he's expelled, he lost all his works, all his writings, everything he had accomplished in life, gone, buried under a tree, can't get back there. Upon leaving Lisbon, he attempted to recover his hidden treasure, But being discovered by the guards, he's thrown into prison. And then he kind of comes out. He goes to Fez, Morocco. You know, you can leave, go from Spain, Gibraltar, and you get right down to Morocco. So there he resided for 10 years. He came there very poor. Soon after his arrival, he fell ill. And he had great privations and terrible sufferings. On his recovery, he recommitted to paper from memory the following works. So from memory, he writes these works. So whenever he quotes something, you wonder, why is he quoting? I've never really heard that before. Is this a source that we're not aware of? Or is he getting it wrong from memory? So he has an incredible memory, but also it might be a little bit flawed. So we're not always sure. So is it his interpretation or not? We just don't know. So he wrote a book of Eshkol HaKofer on Ruth and Esther. And we have them today. They've been republished, beautiful editions. The Torah Chaim, or on the Song of Songs, and the Treatise of Brachot. So I don't know. And the Torah Mor is the commentary on Pentateuch, which we have today, thank God. And I've read almost every line in that book. And it uses the simple meaning of the text, as we've discussed in other lectures in this series, but also on the mystical meanings based on the Zohar. As a matter of fact, he writes that whenever he says something interesting, you might wonder, where did he get it from? He said it's probably from the Zohar. And the Torah Kesef, he wrote on legal decisions. The book is supposed to be a manuscript, I'm not sure. And then Berkei Avot, it's out there, but it's hard to read. Book of Job, maybe it's out there somewhere in manuscript. So let's see where so we already saw that the Rav Avraham Sivan, who lived around the time of the expulsion from Spain, had to live in three different countries. First Spain, then Morocco, then Portugal, and then Morocco. He was lucky that he didn't get converted forcibly in Portugal like most people, but he was able to escape, but nonetheless lost his children, lost his writings. We saw that he does some autobiography in his introductions, but also in the commentary itself. He doesn't just write, you know, this is the meaning of this, this is the meaning of that. But he tries to relate it to his day. Now, partially that's because he's a preacher. He very often says, when I was preaching in Fez, when I was preaching over here, he's a preacher. So his commentary is sort of in the style of a preacher. And a preacher always relates to the times he lives in. But also because, somehow he feels comfortable to sort of weave in his autobiography with his commentary. He sometimes tells you, I wrote this when I was over here, and I wrote that when I was over there. So listen to what he says about the Shema, the Shema Yisrael. We know that the rabbis interpret that you should love your God with all your heart and all your soul. They say that even if God takes your soul, even if, God forbid, you have to give your life for God, you do it. That's part of dying for the sake, sanctification of God's name. So he says that's the Shema. The Torah anticipated the end of all sorrow, the end of the ultimate thing, ultimate sorrows. He believed he lived in the end of times, which they will decree on Israel to take us away from Torah, and that we should not engage in Torah. There'll be times when the Gentiles say, don't engage in Torah. As it happened in the expulsion from Portugal, and they decreed that one should not preach in public. Can't teach. Not teach the children. And they took all the books and the Batei Knesset. They took the synagogues away so they could not daven or learn Torah until Torah was almost lost from Israel. For how can they teach their children without a book or a teacher? And all that was left to teach was Shema Yisrael. You could always teach your children quietly, secretly, teaching them Shema, to know that Hashem is one. That is why he gave us a short parsha, which covers the whole Torah, about learning Torah and ever loving God. And they will teach this verse to the children. And if the Belial, those no goodniks, come to take him away from Hashem, away from God, he will teach him to give his life for the Kiddush Hashem. If they can't teach the whole paragraph, at least he should know one paragraph that says, that the unity of God. So this is like a secret potion we have. We have this secret potion called the Shema, which even if they take everything away from us, all of our books, all of our schools, all of our shuls, this one verse you can teach them in like as a rebellion against the Gentiles and tell them, here is our Lord, is our God, the Lord is one, and we're committed to him, we love him, and we're devoted to it. If you can just teach that, that's the secret sauce. It's one verse that covers all of Judaism. It's one paragraph. It tells you all the important things you need to know about Judaism. It's like that secret capsule to preserve Judaism forever. So in his commentary, he's saying that the Shema was written for this era. He brings in the era in which he lives. He tells the story that he's going through in order to explain the text that is in front of him. It's not just a dispassionate text about, well, what does this mean? The Shema means that there's only one God, and you should love God means you should love God, and tefillin means tefillin. No, he's applying it to the particular exigencies of his time. He also writes as follows that the tefillin says you make a sign on your hand. So we know the sign is the tefillin. We have an official notion of what the phylacteries look like, what should be inside the phylacteries, the various portions of the Shema and other portions from Exodus 13. But he says, what if you're in a time when you can't even have a bris milah, you can't even have circumcision, you can't learn Torah, you can't wear tefillin. But if Torah says you should put a sign on your hand, it's all right. Take a little red thread and put it around your hand, and that'll remind you of the blood of the covenant. Maybe you can't even have a bris, but you'll use that as a sign. So I think, I don't know, I never studied whether the conversos did this, but it seems to me that it's a tradition about conversos that the secret Jews of Portugal, maybe Spain too, would wear a red item to remind them of the covenant, almost like a type of tefillin. So again, secret advice for the secret Jews in his commentary, something for the day, the period in which he lived. Also, we'll find various passages in which he speaks about resilience, about suffering. What do you do with suffering? He says, look at the story of Esau. Jacob is running around trying to spare his life, trying to have some kids and managing with all his wives and his father-in-law and all this. Meantime, we learn about Esau. Esau has a whole bunch of kings. He marries a woman who's in the royal family of the Hittites. And right away, his great success, and there are kings and everything. He says, no, look carefully. First, there are kings. First, he's Esau. Then he becomes intermarried with the kings. Then it talks about just Alufim generals. And then it talks about Esau, who Edom. He goes back to being Esau at the end of the story. So he goes up, but then he goes down. But not the Jews. The Jews are going to are going to continue going up. We are going to what does he say? He says, don't worry, they'll fall down. And he says that he mentioned this when he was in Castile. There were a lot of rabbis there. They liked it. But then one fellow said to him, I think that's in the Zohar. And he said, oh, if you can find it, that's fine. But he never found it. What is he saying? He's saying, I'm an expert in the Zohar. Somebody said that something was in the Zohar. I said, no. I know it's not in the Zohar. Now that requires great knowledge. You can't, to say that something's in the Zohar, anybody can say that. If you read one line, you can say it. But to know what's not in the Zohar, that required great scholarship. And he says, I was right. I told him it wasn't in the Zohar, and it wasn't. But we see that sometimes he gave public lectures and people would interact with him, and he was trying to give people chizuk, give people comfort. Similarly, in Parsha Nitzavim, at the end of the Torah had just finished giving terrible rebuke. It says, you're going to have, if you don't follow the commandments, you're going to be chased out of Israel, and you're going to have cannibalism, and you're going to be sold for slaves, and no one's even going to want to buy you. Not only will you be a slave, but no one's going to want to buy you. Stand on the slave stand and say, hey, anybody want to buy this guy? And everyone's going to say, no, we don't want any Jews. So that's how bad it's going to get. So he says, let me explain something. The Talmud says in Brachos that, look, there's salt, and the covenant of salt, that our covenant with God is like salt preserves. Our covenant is forever. And so too, there's a covenant with afflictions. What's that? The story in Nitzavim or in Kitavo, the end of Deuteronomy, where it says that there'll be terrible things that happen to the Jewish people. What is that? Afflictions. So there's a covenant about afflictions. What do you mean a covenant? Just like salt preserves us, so too the covenant of afflictions preserves. And what's this parsha called after the discussion of the afflictions of the exile? What is it called? A tent of you. You are standing here today. You're firm. You're strong. The more afflictions you have, the stronger you get. He says to the Jews of that time, I thank a certain professor in Israel for bringing this point. He says, he turns to the Jews of that time and he says, Jews, you're suffering from the Christian persecutions and all that. Don't worry. All the affliction is going to make us even stronger. say that about the Israelis today, that despite all their troubles and their wars, they're even happier than anybody else. Why? Because afflictions make us stronger. That's the Tzur HaMor. He is a preacher. He lost his writings. He had to rewrite everything from memory. Didn't have a lot of books with him where he was in Morocco. And he also is very autobiographical, and he uses his commentaries like a catharsis and also as an encouragement to the people he's preaching to. And that's his story. Let's look at the Abravanel. We'll see a lot of interesting parallels. So here I turn to Wikipedia. You can read it there as well. Abravanel. Abravanel was born in Lisbon, Portugal, one of the oldest, most distinguished Iberian Jewish families. Abravanel, or the Abravanel, the professor Netanyahu, you know, that's prime minister's father, wrote a book about Abravanel, and has a footnote there where it says that there could be 9 or 11 different pronunciations of Abravanel. Abravanel, a lot of people say either Abravanel or Abravanel, but it's a very common family. It's a very big family, and today a lot of people are descended from him. He escaped a massacre. The family escaped a massacre in the Castile in 1391 in Spain, and they came to Lisbon. They came to Portugal. He may have been a student, or maybe not, of the rabbi of Lisbon, the last rabbi in Lisbon, Rabbi Yosef Chayun, whose commentary on Pirkei Avos we have. He became well-versed in rabbinic literature and the learning of his time, devoting his early years to the study of Jewish philosophy, and he wrote on Devarim very early in his life. At 20 years old, he wrote about the natural elements and religious questions. He got a very classic education. He learns. He often quotes in his commentary on Pirkei Avos, quotes Cicero. He studied some of the church fathers. He knew Aristotle. He was a very well-read person for those times. And together with his intellectual abilities, he showed complete mastery of financial matters in two ways. Number one, as a treasurer, in the sense of helping the different nations with their finances, but also as a great wealthy man. So he became fabulously wealthy, as his father was wealthy too. And we're going to see that it's unbelievable how wealthy he was. He used his high position and the great wealth he had inherited from his father to aid his co-religionists. When his patron, Alfonso, was captured in the city of Arzila in Morocco, the Jewish captives, when his patron captured the city in Morocco, the Jewish captives were going to be sold as slaves. So Abravanel contributed a great amount of money to save them. After the death of Alfonso, he was obligated to relinquish his office. He was accused of connivance with the Duke of Braganza, and he was executed. So he ran away, and in 1483, he loses all of the money and runs away. Some say he took some of his money with him. At Toledo, he engaged in biblical studies, and in 6 months after he lost his job, he wrote on the book of Judges, Joshua, Judges, and Samuel. There's a whole book, like 500 pages. He writes it in 6 months, an unbelievable achievement. Brilliant man. Shortly afterward, he entered the service of the House of Castile. He got involved he had worked for the Portuguese. Now he works for the Spaniards in Castile. And he had a friend who was an influential converso, someone who converted to Christianity, named Don Abraham Senor. And together they undertook to farm the revenues and to supply provisions for the royal army. And the Queen Isabella of the Castile was very impressed with him. As the Spaniards reconquered all of Spain for the Christians, the Reconquisto, Abravanel gave lots of money to the king. But then there was an edict of expulsion. But he was offered to stay in Spain as a Jew, but he refused. He went to Naples. And he entered the service of the king there. He was in good shape, except at one point the French came and took all his possession, and he went to Corfu, and then he settled in the different places in Italy. Till he went to Venice, and then he was employed, where his services were employed in negotiating commercial treaties between Portugal and the Venetian Republic. So he worked both in the government of Portugal, Spain, and different parts of Italy. There was no Italy in those days, but different provinces. He often expended tremendous wealth, like the equivalent of $1 million, to save the Jews in Spain. He tried to get Ferdinand to stop expelling the Jews. He said, speak to Isabella. Isabella didn't want to do it. Torquemada, the grand inquisitor, said, what are you going to do? How can you let these Jews betray Jesus? And so it became a whole crisis. Maybe he extended the expulsion by 2 days or something. He didn't have much success there. He died in Venice. He was buried in Padua, but we don't know exactly where his grave is. So a fascinating story, a man who was so wealthy, and he lost his fortune, was able to regain his fortune. Wherever he went, they wanted him to be a finance minister. He helped participate. He gave funds to fund these governments to help them function. He was in with Ferdinand and Isabella, these villains of Jewish history who expelled the Jews from Spain. He was close with them before that. It's unbelievable. At the same time, he was able to write commentaries on almost the entire Torah, mostly when he got older, but some of it in the midst of all this fantastic political activity. Unbelievable. Who ever heard of someone so capable in so many different areas? It's unbelievable who this man was. And of sort of the Sephardic image of somebody who's broad and well-read and involved in commerce and politics, similar to Shmuel Hanagi, one of the great Sephardic heroes. As opposed to the Ashkenazic community, we tended to be more inward. We were involved in the Torah study and things like that, less so than the Spanish Jews, who had a broader sort of view. So he's the ultimate sort of Sephardic worldly kind of a type. Now, the notion, but there's an interesting detail here in relation to the Torah Amor. So the Torah Amor buried his books in Lisbon and was never able to recover them. He had to recover them from memory. However, the Abravanel had much better luck. He took all his possessions. He escaped with just himself from Castile. He was fearful for his life, and it was the end of all his books. So he was traveling, et cetera, et cetera. Then I entered a boat in the sea. With God's mercy, I came to the island of Corfu, off the peninsula there. And I dwelt there, and God chanced upon me, in front of me, what I had done as commentary on this book of Devarim, on Deuteronomy. And my soul was glad. I held it and kissed it. And I said, I will add to it. So what happened? He was escaping. And he goes to a city, and they probably have a shul there. He goes to the shul, he takes out a sitter. He says, I have a few books here. Let me see what they got here. He looks at the books, and one of the books is his book on Devarim, the book that he had left in the previous place, whereas the Torah Mor buried all his books, and that was the end of it. He found his book, but he realized it's years later, he needs to add to it, and God has spared his life. And all this circumstance, he needs to learn more. Every time he was persecuted, he said to himself, I wish I could learn more. I need to learn more. And he would write another commentary and another commentary. So he always felt guilty about not learning enough, and he would keep writing more and more. So these two rabbis, the Torah Mor, lost his writings. The Abravanel found his writings. And that would be true throughout history. The Abravanel would be well studied throughout the ages. And the Torah Mor, until recent times, nobody ever heard of him. Many of you probably never heard of him. He always had bad luck. Now, I mentioned that both these commentators, there's the nexus between the commentator and the commentary. That the commentary is not just some dispassionate discussion of the Torah and its meaning, but that it's also grounded in things that happened to them, an autobiography. One professor said that it's amazing. He sort of wrote his political memoir as part of the commentary. Think about it. If he'd just written a memoir, who would read it? It would be lost somewhere. But since he included his memoir, as did the Torah Mor, within his commentary, everybody likes a good commentary, so the commentary still exists, and therefore his political memoir still exists as well. In Deuteronomy 4, Parshat Vayetchanan, the reading we read on Tisha B'Av, it says that, in difficult times, you'll seek God and you'll find him, and when you seek him with all your heart. So he says, that what does it mean? And then you're going to go to exile, you're going to worship other gods. He says, no, you're not going to worship God. Who? The Jews are going to worship other gods? No. you worship other gods by force, like the conversos, like the secret Jews, like the Muranos, like those who were forced to leave their faith and practice Christianity in the open, whereas they practice Judaism secretly. They're going to seek God and they'll believe in God. And from there, even in Spain or in Portugal, they're going to find God if they seek him with all their heart. What does it mean, all their heart? He says, look, if you're forced to Christianity, you have to do Christianity, but hearts with all of their heart. Now, you can't be you know, half Christian, half Jewish. If you believe in God, that's terrific. And then you can find God even in that circumstance. He says, in the end of days, you'll find all these things. So he interprets the verses in light of his situation in the conversos in his time, just like Torah Mor interpreted about the tefillin, as that there could be signs that people in the conversos would make signs for themselves. So too, the Abravanel interpreted that there would be that there's a time when you would seek God, even though you had to do so just in your heart. You couldn't do so publicly because of the persecutions. The Abravanel relates his commentary to modern times also in a polemical way. Now, there are various reasons and conditions under which you might make your commentary more relevant to your times. The Torah Mor might make it more relevant because he's a preacher. Preachers always talk about current events, as you know, your local rabbi may do. The Rabbi Abravanel might preach sometimes too, but more importantly, I think he viewed many of his writings as polemics against the Rambam and certain radical ideas that he had, and against ideas of his time. So there's a polemic in the Torah Mor and Parshat Nitzavim about against those who just think that Judaism should be in your heart and just philosophy, but not so much in action. And he's against those folks. So too in Deuteronomy 28, the Ramban wants to deal with the following problem. He said, there were, among the Gentiles, I saw someone saying that the first rebuke at the end of Vayikra were about Babylonian destruction. And therefore there's a consolation at the end, which is the second temple. But the curses in the Parsha of Kitavo in the end of Deuteronomy are about the second temple and have no consolation because there will be no other redemption. So Catholics made a very scary argument against the Jews. Said, you're waiting for Mashiach, right? You think Mashiach's going to come? Forget it. It's never going to come. Why? You have two rebukes. The Jews are rebuked in the end of Leviticus that if you don't follow the commandments, this is what will happen. But the end of the rebuke is, I won't destroy you and I'll remember the covenant, everything will be okay. That refers to the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. Second rebuke is for the people in the second temple. And then it says, if you don't follow the commandments, that's it. At the end of the rebuke, it doesn't say, but then you'll be okay. It doesn't say that. It says it in the Tzavim, but it doesn't say it in chapter 28 in the rebuke section, in Parashat Ki Tavo. There's no happy ending to that story. It says, you know why there's no happy ending? Because it's not going to be a redemption. So it's a very severe reaction. Of course, that doesn't mean you should follow Christianity, which seems to go against the idea of the Shema Yisrael, against the oneness of God. But just in terms of the Christian argument about redemption, it seems to argue a very nice, a nice, neat interpretation that you see when it comes to the second temple, there's no redemption. Once you were destroyed, that's it. We're finished. We're never going to come back. So he says, yeah, you think the first rebuke in Leviticus is only about the first temple? It's not about the second temple at all? I don't think so. And you think the second one is only about the first temple, not the second temple? He says, and secondly, do you think there were two redemptions? The redemption of the first temple, and then there was going to be another redemption? He says, are you kidding me? You think the second temple is a redemption? Second temple is not a redemption. What do you mean? Firstly, there were many Jews it was not a total gathering of the exiles. Only 40,000 Jews came back. The Jews who lived in Greece and Italy never came back for the Second Temple. And there were Jews during the Second Temple in those countries. He says, we didn't have the Ark wasn't there in the Second Temple. There was no anointing oil. There was no fire from heaven. There was no Urim Vatum. You couldn't ask the breastplate a question. It wouldn't answer. He says, that's not a temple. You call that a temple? There was no sovereignty. the Jews, he says, let's say today the Ottomans would tell the Jews, okay, you can go back to Israel. And then 5 minutes later, they tell them they can't go back to Israel. Would that be redemption? It's not redemption. So he says, what are you talking about? So there never was a second redemption. So you can't tell me the first rebuke is about the first redemption and the second one's the second one. There's no redemption. So there's a polemic against the Christians. But he's using his commentary to tell the Jews of his time what they should do and in response to various vicious attacks on their future. Similarly, in his commentary to the Ovadia, the Christians said that the prophecies were already fulfilled, and he says, no. When it says in Ovadia that the Edomites, which are interpreted to mean the Romans, that the Romans will one day be destroyed, he says, we're still under the Romans. He says, the Byzantine Empire, the Christians, they're all Romans. He says, even the Muslims, they were originally ruled by the Romans and then they became Muslims. The Romans, the Muslims, it's all Rome. From a conceptual point of view, they're Rome, and therefore we still have not been saved from Rome, and we are looking forward to our redemption. His commentary to Daniel is completely polemical because he wants to prove that although times are so bad, I mean, the Jews had to be dispersed, hundreds of thousands of people dispersed throughout the whole Ottoman Empire, through Northern Africa, everyone's dispersed and displaced. Abravanel says, don't worry. Redemption is coming soon. He predicted the Messianic redemption in the year 1503, even though he died in 1508. So he never saw the fulfillment of his vision. Why does he say 1503? Because Daniel says that in a time, times, and half a time, you'll be redeemed. So it's Daniel 12:7. So what does it mean? Time and times, that's times is two, and times one, so that's 2 + 1 = 3, and a half a time, that's 3.5. If you take the amount of years the Jews had their first temple, which is, he says, 410 years, and you multiply it by 3.5, you get 1435. It's 1435 years after 68 CE, the Common Era, when the temple was destroyed, according to him. We usually say the temple was destroyed in 70, but some people say it was destroyed in 68. If you add it to 1435 to year 68, you get 1503. So he believed the Mashiach was coming soon. In other words, he had a polemic. He was trying to show, give people encouragement. Everyone says that Rashi was also trying to give people encouragement. The Ramban's giving people encouragement. Commentaries are often written to give people encouragement. The Abravanel's commentary on Daniel is to give people encouragement. Mashiach is coming soon. We know that the great Ari also felt that way, that Mashiach is coming soon. You can see in Lechadodi of Shlomo Alkovitz that they felt redemption is coming soon. In the Midid Nefesh, Hushana Valtitalein should come quickly. The redemption they felt, the exiles felt, the redemption has got to be coming. Things are so bad. Redemption must be coming soon, like a lot of people feel today. So many bad things going on. Surely, redemption must be coming soon. He wrote in the introduction to Daniel that, you know, a lot of people have given up. They say, Mashiach's not coming. It's no good. So he says, I'm coming to be a petach tikva, to open up hope for all the Jews. And that's why I wrote my commentary. Similarly, in Isaiah, he writes that, you know, that no matter what, all the waters can overcome me. No, don't worry about it. If all the waters overcome you, I'll still be okay. What does that mean? That even if you're baptized and you're baptized again, and as a converso, and people forcibly converted to Christianity by the Spaniards, you'll still be Jewish. And he says that, I called out your name. Once a Jew is called by the name of Israel, never, you can't be transferred to something else. Even if your new name is Pablo Christiani, you are still Jewish. So he interprets the verses in Isaiah to mean that no matter how much you convert and all that, you will still one day be able to escape and repent. And they'll be able to escape. And that's what happened. The Jews from these lands where they became forcibly converted, they ran to the lands of Ishmael, Muslim lands, and the Togarmah, which is the Turks, and they went to Turkey and the Ottoman Empire, and they repented came back. Because even if you go through fire, you will not burn. The Holy One of Israel will save you. And those left, God will take revenge, etc. So he gives the people encouragement there will be a great gathering of the Jews who are called in the name of Jacob, even if the conversos, anyone called by the name of his children, even if he sits among the Gentiles, will be saved. Finally, most famously, the Barbanel brings his experience to his commentary, his experience as a commentator, as a person, to his commentary, to his theoretically dispassionate discussion about what the Torah means. He brings it to bear when talking about kings. The issue of kings come up a lot. In the book of Devarim, it comes up as it says, if people will ask for a king, you should give them a king. So the question is, if they don't ask for a king, you shouldn't give them a king. Why do you have to wait for them to ask? How come Samuel was against kingship, and then God loves David, and he makes an eternal covenant with David? So which one is it? Does God hate kingship? Does God love kingship? So it's so ambiguous. So he says, let me tell you, if you think kingship is necessary because you have to have one person to organize everything, and if you don't have a king, there'll be chaos. He says, what are you talking about? Did you know, did you not hear the great land governed over the whole world, consume the whole earth, search and note it while its leadership was through the councils? They had like a parliament. They didn't have a king. They were wholesome, and many of their leadership was temporary. They had elections. First they had this king, this leader, and then they had another leader. However, afterward, they were made a tributary. And also today, the Commonwealth of Venice, there was no Italy then, so there were different commonwealths, different little fiefdoms over there. And the great mistress among the nations, ruler over states, the country of Florence was apparently a country in those days, the beauty of all lands, it's so beautiful. And other countries, small and large, are run by the mouth of leaders elected for certain periods of time. Behold, the elected governments have in them nothing perverse or crooked. There's nothing bad. No one raises his hand or foot to do wrongful thing. No, there's not a lot of crime there because there's no king. And they conquer lands and, you know, a successful country in those days, in the days of the Christopher Columbus, you know, successful country, they were able to go out and conquer land. So there must be good countries. And all this shows that the presence of a king is not necessary for a nation. And it's a wonder about this supposed opinion that compares the unity of the human king over the control and rule of the people with the unity of the ancient, the first cause. He says, some people compare the king to God. He said, what are you talking about? You don't need a king. So having experienced many kings and how bad, terrible they were, he believed that kingship was not a good thing. You don't have to have it. And he used the notion of democracies in his day or parliamentary systems in his day or partial, you know, combined monarchy and parliamentary system. He used that to prove that kingship is not a necessity for having an organized kingdom. So we see again that the Barbanel uses his knowledge of the days of as a commentator, as a person. He uses that knowledge to explain the text. You see, Rashi, in his commentary on the Chumash and on Talmud, uses his knowledge of the world to explain the laws of winemaking because he knew how the wine worked, the laws of commerce because he knew how commerce worked, the laws of weaving because he watched the weavers weave. So he's aware of sort of practical things. But for the Rabbi Brunel, as a broader person, a little more experienced, he's able to draw from the politics of his time to explain the verses in Deuteronomy and in Shmuel. So both the Brunel and his contemporary, the Tzora Mor, who didn't necessarily meet each other, didn't necessarily interact with each other. I mean, different. One is more Western and one is more mystical. They're different, but they both use that sort of autobiographical tone to describe certain things, to explain certain phenomena, and that both because of the tradition of being preachers, both in terms of engaging in certain polemics, but also because they didn't see their commentary simply as an academic discussion of what the Torah means, as perhaps Rashi, even Ramban did. They saw their commentary also as an opportunity to share things about that were going on in their times and relate the issues of conversos and forced conversions and secret Jews to the text itself, to encourage people as well, as many commentaries are written to encourage people of your own time. We saw Rashi has an agenda sort of as an ethical preacher and teacher. We saw the Ramban trying to show the beauty of the Torah and connecting this in the simple meanings of the Midrash. And here we saw the Ramban and the Torah more trying to use the verses and the Torah itself to inspire people and to explain current crises and to give people encouragement in these very difficult times. So I think we saw that the Rabbi Nel and the Torah more, Rabbi Avraham Savan, they have certain similarities, but also certain great differences as well. One a mystic, one lost his books and had to rewrite from memory. One found his books. One had a great fame as a Rabbi Nel, great wealth. One was tremendously poor and had a very, very difficult life in the case of the Torah more. But both use their commentary to draw on the times in which they lived to enrich their commentary and to enrich their understanding of the text. Thank you for joining us for this three-part series about knowing your commentators. Thanks for joining us here at the Baron Rouge Congregation. Thanks to our sponsors, and thanks to Jason Lefkowitz, our producer.